him aflame the way Gracie had. He told himself it was because he couldn't get out of his own head. When he'd been with Jamie, a sommelier, she'd taken him to wine tastings, and together they'd spent a week in Napa. "I like wine," he told Sarah, who just shrugged. When he'd been with Miranda, who worked in business affairs for one of the networks and loved to ride her bike, he'd started taking bike trips. "It's an excellent workout, very low impact," he said, when Sarah merely raised her eyebrows at the $5,000 carbon frame road bike he'd bought. And instead of getting dumped, whenever a relationship hit the 6-month mark, when it was time to either break up or commit to going forward, with everything that would entail, Sam would always opt to leave. He'd never been sure with the bone-deep certainty that marriage required that the woman he was with was the right woman for him, the one he could be with for the rest of his life. When you know, you know, everyone from Sarah to Marcus to his own father had said, and so far, Sam hadn't. He didn't want to waste anyone's time, especially as he and the women he dated both got older. He also, he realized, didn't want to get his heart broken again or told that there was something missing about him. So he made sure that he was the one who did the dumping. Then he'd met Julie. He'd been in line at Whole Foods, paying for his hot food bar dinner of salmon and greens, when he heard the woman in front of him apologizing as she rooted frantically through a leather purse stained black at one corner where a pin had exploded. "I'm so sorry. I think I left my wallet in my other purse." She was wearing a long, loose-fitting sundress and dangly gold earrings, with her brown hair slipping out of a bun that appeared to have been secured with one of the elastic bands that postmen used to wrap the mail. Sam watched her pull things out of the seemingly bottomless bag, a pair of leggings, a single kid-sized sneaker, a water bottle, a lip gloss, a sample-sized box of dental floss, a plastic bag full of goldfish crackers. Her face flushed when she pulled out a tampon. She was biting her lower lip, sweat beading faintly at her hairline, as the boy beside her tugged at the skirt of her dress and said, "Mama, I have to go potty." "Oh, God," the woman breathed. "Can you use Apple Pay?" asked the cashier, nodding at her iPhone. There were 5 people in line, counting Sam, and a few of them were starting to grumble. "What? Oh, no, I'm sorry. I've been meaning to figure it out. God, I'm such a ditz. I'm so sorry." She started rummaging in her bag again, and Sam saw her eyes shining with tears. She didn't appear to be broke. Sam thought her bag and her dress both looked expensive, but she was obviously ashamed. Beyond the immediate chagrin, Sam saw resignation in the slump of her shoulders, the twist of her lips. "This is what always happens," her face and her posture projected. "This is the way it will always be. If you can just maybe put my things aside and I'll run right home and..." "Here." Sam reached past her, extending his credit card. "I've got it." "Oh, no, really, that's so nice, but I can't let you." The woman and the boy were both looking at him. They had the same pale skin, the same round faces and fine brown hair and eyes that tilted down at the corners. "It's no problem," he said, handing the cashier his card. "Oh, God, thank you. Thank you so much. That's so kind of you." Her face was alight, and Sam felt something in his heart shift as the cashier handed him back his card. The woman's name was Julie Barringer. Her son's name was Connor. Julie told Sam that she managed at a music store on the Sunset Strip, that she was divorced, and that she and Connor lived with Julie's father in a mansion on Coldwater Canyon. Officially, Julie and her ex-husband shared custody, but for all practical purposes, Julie was raising Connor alone. "His dad means well," she said on her first date with Sam at a sushi restaurant near her shop. Connor's father's name was Jason. He played the guitar. Julie had met him when he'd brought it in to have his truss rod adjusted. and he'd been a member of 4 different bands. Each one of them had, Julie said, been on the cusp of success at one point, but none of them had ever quite made it. Jason does studio work mostly, and he travels, and he doesn't make a lot of money, so he's not too consistent with his child support. Well, I guess it's good that you've got your father, Sam said. Instead of answering, Julie nibbled a bit of seaweed salad and asked Sam about his own family. Sam was happy to discuss his twin sister, married, stepmother of 1 and mother of 2, all of which he thought recommended him as a suitor, as well as his parents, who just celebrated 35 years together. My father's a lawyer. He did mostly corporate litigation, but lately he's gotten involved in more pro bono work. Tenants' rights, immigration, things like that. Julie nodded her approval as Sam talked about his dad. How Lee Weinberg hadn't been especially athletic, but had volunteered to coach all of Sam's youth league teams. How he wasn't a fan of classical music, but had faithfully attended every one of Sarah's recitals. And how, on the weekends, he'd been the one to drive them both to their various camps and games and lessons so that their mother could have some quiet time. My mom's retired now, but she used to be an English professor. She wrote 2 novels back in the 1980s before my sister and I were born. Julie set her chopsticks down. Her round eyes were open wide. Her face was curious. Why'd she stop? Sam shook his head. His mom had never talked much about her writing days. I'm not sure. I think she didn't like going on book tours or being away from us. Frowning, Julie asked, but wouldn't that only have been for a few days a year? If that, Sam said. I don't know if she didn't like writing anymore or if she just liked teaching and being a mom better. I can barely remember my mom. Julie's voice was wistful as she smoothed her chopstick wrapper before starting to fold it into pleats. What happened? Leukemia. It was very fast. I was 5. She gave an unhappy, cynical smile. My father was so mad. Mad at who? Asked Sam. Oh, her doctors, for not figuring it out fast enough. God, my mother, too. I think he felt like she'd failed him. Julie shrugged. He got married again less than a year later, so at least he wasn't afraid to get back on the horse that threw him. She smoothed out her wrapper, then started to fold it again. Then, when Jason left, I remember thinking that I knew I could get through it because I'd gotten through my mom dying. I remember thinking, well, at least it won't be as bad as that was. She bent her head, and Sam wanted to touch her, to hold her hand and tell her everything would be all right. He walked around the table, sat down on the booth beside her, and pulled her close, letting her lean against him, thinking that he wanted to keep her safe and make sure that nothing would ever hurt her again. After a few minutes, Julie lifted her head and managed a tremulous smile. I'm going to the ladies' room, and if you want to leave right now, if you want to just walk out the door and get in your car and pretend we never met, I'm not going to judge you. I promise that I won't. Sam stared at her, incredulous. I'm not going to run out on you, he said. Julie sighed. I might as well give you the whole story, she'd said, before you waste any more time on me. The waitress set down a platter of sushi. Sam picked up his chopsticks and listened as Julie told him that her father, Saul Berenger, had once been in-house counsel for one of the biggest film studios. Hence, Sam supposed, the mansion in the hills. Saul had been married 3 times and had outlived all 3 of his wives, along with a son, Julie's half-brother, who died of an overdose in 1993, and another daughter, an older half-sister, who drowned in a scuba accident in Belize in 2007. Saul was now, Julie said, in the late stages of kidney disease. He's 91, and he's had a quintuple bypass plus skin cancer, so He's not really a candidate for dialysis or a transplant. Just a week ago, following his last hospitalization, his doctors at Cedars-Sinai had sent him home to die. "I guess that's why I've been losing things," Julie said sadly, explaining that, in addition to her wallet, she'd managed to lose her car keys, her garage door opener, and her phone, all in 5 days' time. Shaking her head, she said, "At least I haven't left Connor anywhere." Julie had arranged for her father to have round-the-clock nursing care, plus visits from the hospice nurses. Then she'd moved back home to oversee her father's death. "He didn't ask, but I wanted to be there for him," she'd sighed, her face resolving into what Sam would come to recognize as the expression she wore when discussing one of the men who'd let her down. Her eyes were downcast, her lower teeth dug into her upper lip. "I thought maybe he'd have, like, a moment of clarity, and he'd tell me he loved me or tell Connor that he loved him. But I think all my dad ever really loved was his job and earning money and screwing other people out of it." She'd shaken her head, looking disgusted, either at her father for being so heartless or at herself for speaking that unpleasant truth out loud. "But he's still my dad, and I don't want him to be alone." She'd sniffled, wiped her eyes, and tried to smile, even though Sam could see tears trembling on her eyelashes. "I bet all of this is sounding delightful. Deadbeat ex-husband, dying father, 5-year-old every night of the week." Her voice was shaky. Sam reached for her hands again. He didn't desire Julie the way he'd once desired Gracie all those years ago. It wasn't a return of that desperate passion, but there was something about Julie that called to him, that made him feel capable and strong. Julie and Connor needed him, and that need would give him an identity, a role he could assume without wondering if he'd just glommed onto someone else's interests or hobbies or way of being in the world, and wouldn't entail his sister lifting her eyebrow and quietly observing that it was a good thing he'd never dated a woman who'd been in a cult. Julie needed him, and Sam discovered that he liked feeling needed. Julie believed the world to be a terrible place, full of unkind people, and Sam wanted to show her that it wasn't. There was also Connor, who was curious and smart and affectionate, and who would slip his hand into Sam's when it was time to cross the street or ask for help zipping his jacket. "You're sure you're cool with the whole stepdad thing?" Marcus asked. Marcus and Aubrey had 3 kids of their own by then. Marcus had swapped his stoner ponytail for a gelled pompadour and had traded his collection of ratty t-shirts and cargo shorts for $1,000 suits and raw silk ties. These days, he used his confidence, what he referred to unironically as his raw animal magnetism, to attract clients instead of bed partners. He was a devoted father to his daughters, a loving husband to his wife, and still Sam's sensei when it came to all things female-related. "Why wouldn't I be? Raising another man's kid?" Marcus's voice trailed off. "Connor's father's barely around," Sam said, "and his grandfather's terrifying." Marcus shook his head. "Dementia's a bitch," he said. And Sam, who thought that Saul Behringer was probably a terror even before he'd started losing his faculties, had nodded in agreement. "And you love Julie? This isn't about, you know, riding to the rescue, slaying the dragon, and rescuing the damsel in distress?" "I love her," Sam said without hesitation. "And I love Connor." Marcus clapped him on the back. "Well, good for you, buddy. If you're happy, I'm happy." Sam had moved in with Julie and Connor 6 weeks later. Julie had warned him that her father's house was a horror show, but even her descriptions had left Sam unprepared for the place. An enormous, vaguely Italianate pile of white marble and pilasters and columns, all odd angles, ill-considered additions, and massive plate glass windows that seemed to scowl down from the top of a serpentine driveway. How many people lived here? he asked, after he'd gotten the tour. The house felt endless, full of rooms with pointlessly high ceilings and windows that caught the light at the wrong part of the day, which meant you were always either blinking through the glare or squinting in the gloom. Julie's mother had liked Spanish architecture, so there were arched doorways and a tiled roof and a fountain inlaid with Moorish mosaics just off the kitchen. Her successor had preferred mid-century modern, so there was a boxy, flat-roofed addition that served as a guest house. Saul had insisted on a grand library with a hulking, antique roll-top desk and floor-to-ceiling shelves stocked with leather-bound, gold-embossed books whose spines had never once been cracked, and a ladder should anyone want to reach them. Just off the Art Deco kitchen, there was a solarium that could have been cheerful if it held anything besides a Stairmaster that looked like it had been abandoned around the time Sam's mother had published her last book. Finally, running the length of the house, there was a living room where giant canvases covered the walls, paintings done exclusively in smears of ochre and maroon and brown. Saul Behringer ruled this kingdom from the throne of his hospital bed. Old age and poor health had taken his ability to walk. Cataracts had stolen most of his vision. He'd started going deaf years ago and refused to wear hearing aids, because according to him, nobody says anything he wants to hear, Julie said. None of those ravages had touched his voice, a raspy, phlegmy, Brooklyn-inflected bellow, which he employed from early in the morning until very late at night, with the occasional break for naps. Saul yelled at the nurses when they turned him to prevent him from developing bed sores. He screamed at the home health aides when they helped him with toileting or tried to bathe him. He berated his daughter. "Stop treating me like an invalid," he'd howl, and Julie would murmur apologies, while Sam thought, "How else is she supposed to treat you? You are an invalid."
"Who are you? What are you doing in my house?"
he'd bellow every single time he caught sight of Sam. Whether he genuinely failed to recognize his daughter's partner or was making an existential point, Sam was never sure. Sometimes Saul would think Sam was the house painter employed by his first wife.
"I don't care what Lori wants. You paint that bathroom pink, and I'm not paying you one single cent."
Sometimes he thought Sam was a partner or a client. One terrible night, he thought Sam was his dead son, Jerry.
"I don't understand why it's got to be heroin," Saul said, in a bellow that somehow managed to be almost plaintive. "Can't you just be a drunk?"
It was brutal. But it wouldn't be for long. "The doctors told me he's got weeks, maybe a month at the longest," Julie said. Sam had no reason to doubt her. Not until he watched Saul hang on for weeks, then a month, then months, plural, shouting at the nurses, screaming at the physical therapists who'd been brought on board, at one of the more optimistic doctors urging to help improve Saul's strength and mobility.
"Why should I walk?" he thundered. "You think I've got anywhere to go?"
The nurses quit and were replaced by new ones, who quit and were replaced in turn. The therapists left, and so did the aides, sometimes just walking out at lunchtime without giving anything resembling notice. Julie even had an entire agency quit on her, refusing to send any more of its staffers for Saul to abuse. After 6 months of this, Sam was convinced that Saul had been pickled in his own nastiness, that he was too awful to ever die. In spite of this, maybe because of it, Sam was spending most of his nights at the mansion. The agencies tried to send male aides because they were the ones who could lift Saul and maneuver him without risk of injury, but there were only so many men doing that work, which meant that at least once a day, Sam would end up wrestling his girlfriend's father in and out of bed, or rolling him from one side to another. "You're so good to me," Julie would say. "I don't deserve you." Sam would kiss her and tell her the truth, that it was no big deal, that he was happy to help. Julie and Connor needed a defender, a champion, someone who spoke to them kindly and treated them well and could stand up to Saul's curses and bellows, and Sam was happy to play that role. Sam did his best to ignore Saul's abuse. He settled into what had been Julie's childhood bedroom and found his own routines within a household that moved to the rhythms of Saul's sleep, Saul's therapies, Saul's needs. He'd get up early to start a pot of coffee, exchange good mornings and updates with the nurse who'd had the overnight shift, and make Connor his lunch. He'd bring Julie a cup of coffee in bed, and she'd sit up, propping her back against the headboard, wrapping her hands around the mug, gazing up at him, saying, "I don't know what I'd do without you." After 6 months, he knew he wanted the three of them to be a family. He discussed it with his own parents. "If you're happy, we're happy." And with Sarah, who'd come through her own wars with Ruby, who was by then a senior in high school. Being a step-parent is a lot to take on, but if you love her, it's worth it. Finally, he talked it over with Connor. "How would you feel if I married your mom?" Connor considered it carefully. "You'd be my dad then?" he asked, his voice hopeful. "Stepdad," Sam said. "But you'd be here, every day and every night? You wouldn't leave?" "No," Sam promised. "I wouldn't leave." "That's good," Connor said. That was all he'd said. But that night, when Sam went to bed, he saw that Connor had taken his most prized possession, his Lego Millennium Falcon, and left it on Sam's pillow as a gift. He'd taken Julie out to dinner, then for a drive in Malibu. They were at an overlook with the ocean crashing underneath them when he gave her the ring. She'd said yes, then she'd cried, then hugged him, then asked if he was sure, then cried some more. "I'm so happy," she'd said, and wiped her eyes. "Boy, did I get lucky that day I forgot my wallet. Best mistake I ever made." "Do you think, should I ask your father for your hand?" Julie looked stricken. "Oh, God, please don't. What if he says no?" "Do you think he would?" Julie gave him a long look. Then she sighed. "He's 91 years old. He can't eat solid food. He can't smoke cigars. He can't golf. He can't drive. And he can't chase women. Tormenting people is the only joy he's got left." "I'm still going to talk to him," Sam decided. And Julie gave him a thin smile and said, "On your head be it." The next morning, after he'd brought Julie her coffee and seen Connor safely into the morning's carpool car, Sam made his way across the vast living room. Mornings were usually Saul's most lucid period. By late afternoon, he'd be raving, yelling at Julie or at a long-dead assistant or travel agent or wife. Once the room had held a sectional couch and a table that sat eight, with eight heavy chairs made of dark carved wood. There'd been floor lamps and tables, all of them, to Sam's eye, almost exquisitely ugly. When he'd gotten sick, Julie's father had demanded that every piece of furniture be pushed against the walls so that his bed could be set up in the very center of the enormous room. It gave the space the appearance of a theater, with Saul center stage, and all those empty chairs and couches waiting for an audience to fill them. To the left of his bed was a rolling tray table covered in bottles of medication, rolls of gauze, tubes of various ointments, a box of baby wipes, a bottle of talcum powder, a bedpan, and a urinal. Sam dragged a chair over the right side. "Saul?" he called. For a moment, Saul Behringer's body remained motionless. Then Saul craned his tanned, wrinkled neck upward and peered around, his bald head turning slowly. He looked like a turtle, Sam thought. Not a kindly one, but an ancient, crafty tortoise with a brutal bite.
"Who's that?"
"It's me, Sam Levy Weinberg."
What kind of name, asked Saul Behringer, his lips curling in a sneer, is Levi Weinberg? Why don't you just call yourself Jew?
Sam didn't respond. The thing about Daddy is, you can't let him bait you, Julia told him. Plus, Sam knew that Saul Behringer had been born Saul Bernstein. Mr. Behringer, Sam said, your daughter and I would like to be married.
Saul pursed his lips. Which daughter is this?
The only one you have left, Sam thought. Julie. Saul closed his eyes.
Julie. Her mother was Lori.
His lips thinned in an approximation of a smile.
Lori was my favorite.
Well, that's nice, Sam thought, as Saul tried to push himself up straight. There was an uncharacteristically fond expression on his face, a softening around his mouth and his eyes. Saul smiled, gently, lost in memory. Then he said,
she could suck the chrome off a trailer hitch.
That isn't nice at all, thought Sam, and considered how awful it would be if Saul Behringer had ended up being the man in Connor's life. Julie and I love each other, he said.
Sweet, Saul said dismissively.
I think we can make each other happy.
Not your job.
Pardon?
I said Saul, shouting each word,
that it is not your job to make someone else happy.
He glared at Sam suspiciously.
A person's happiness is his own business. Or hers.
Sam didn't know what to say. I love her, and I love Connor.
Connor?
Sam supposed he could have ascribed Saul's confusion to his age or his failing health. But Julie had told him that he'd never bothered to acquaint himself with any of his grandchildren.
That's her boy, right? The musician's son?
Yes, that's Connor, your grandson. Saul thought it over, and eventually grunted.
Fine, only don't think I'm paying for anything, he'd added before Sam could thank him.
He lifted one arthritic finger with its horny nail in the air and jabbed it at Sam.
I already paid for one wedding. It's one per customer.
We'll pay, Sam promised. And Saul had waved him away with one age-spotted paw and started looking around for a nurse to berate. That afternoon, Sarah called Julie to start planning the wedding, a ceremony at a restaurant with dinner and dancing after, and Connor serving as the ring-bearer, Marcus as Sam's best man, and Sarah as his best woman. Julie's father wasn't well enough to leave the house, which Sam regarded as more of a blessing than a disappointment. Lee and Ronnie flew in from Boston. Sarah and Eli and their kids had come from New York, and Gracie had come from Seattle, and Marcus had arranged a bachelor party. Sam had bargained him down from a strip club and a steakhouse to Cirque du Soleil and In-N-Out Burger. The wedding had been exactly what Sam and Julie had hoped for. Julie told Sam that she'd already survived a 200-person blowout that her parents had insisted upon when she'd married Connor's father, and had hated the entire experience. I just want a great party, where there's a 15-minute interlude for the ceremony, she'd said. And Sam, with his mother's and sister's help, had done his best to oblige her. Julie had chosen the restaurant. His sister had helped her plan the menu. His parents had come out a week early to help.
Tell me about the kind of work you did, Lee Weinberg had said to Julie's father, pulling a chair up to Saul's hospital bed,
and Saul, recognizing a fellow attorney, had expounded at length on the advantageous deals he'd made over the years, and was happier than Sam had ever seen him. Sarah stood up with him at the ceremony, holding one of the poles of the huppah, beaming her approval as he slipped the ring on Julie's finger.
Mazel tov, Marcus yelled,
after Connor carefully placed a napkin-wrapped light bulb under his heel, and Sam had stomped down hard. Julie's typically tremulous, worried face was wreathed in smiles for the entire night
except for the few minutes when she'd cried during their vows. Sam and Julie had danced until 2 in the morning and spent the night in a bungalow at the Beverly Hills Hotel. "Promise you'll never leave me," Julie had whispered, holding his shoulders with a panicky force, pressing her body against his so tightly it felt to Sam like she was trying to push herself through his skin. "I'll never leave," Sam had whispered back. The next morning, Sarah brought Connor to the hotel. His sister and stepson and parents had joined them for brunch. Then Sam and Julie and Connor had left for a family honeymoon in Maui at a resort that offered a kids' camp, so the newlyweds had plenty of time to be alone. Sam found that he liked cooking. He'd FaceTime with his sister every morning while he made Connor's lunch, filling bento boxes with radish rosebuds and edamame and neatly portioned servings of grilled chicken and rice. He would make Connor's bed after a few bad run-ins with Legos taught him to wear shoes before entering the boy's bedroom. And when Connor came home from school, Sam would prepare a snack, and together they'd watch a half hour of anime on TV. On weekends, Sam would take Connor to visit Dogs at the Pound in hopes of getting their own pet at some unspecified date, when Grandpa Saul, who hated animals as much as he hated most people, had gone on to his reward. They started reading James and the Giant Peach together at night. Connor was enchanted with the idea of a giant, inhabitable fruit. "Do you think something like that could really happen?" he'd asked, and Sam said, "I don't think so." But he still caught Connor looking wistfully into the backyard, where apricots and avocados and oranges grew. Julie was reluctant to leave her father for any length of time, but Sam coaxed her to spend a weekend camping at Big Sur and a week of skiing in Jackson Hole during spring break, where they'd shared a house with Sarah and Eli and Dexter and Miles. In June, Sam's parents hosted them and Sarah and Eli and Ruby and the boys for a week on the Cape. And Sam and Julie and Connor visited Sarah and Eli in New York City right before Christmas, where they saw 2 Broadway shows and took Connor to see the store's holiday displays and went skating in Rockefeller Center one cold, starry night. For the duration of the marriage, Sam and Julie and Connor were a merry little band of 3. They did their best to ignore the malevolent, shouting presence in the living room, a thing that sometimes seemed more dead than alive. Each night in bed, instead of "I love you," Julie would say, "It won't be much longer," and Sam would say it back, "It won't be much longer." One afternoon in May of 2019, just over a year after he and Julie were married, Sam had been home prepping salmon fillets for dinner when the doorbell had rung.
"Tell them we don't want any," Saul had yelled from his bed in the living room. "Tell them we gave at the office."
Sam wiped his hands on a dish towel and went to answer the door. 2 police officers were standing there. "Mr. Berenger?" the first one, a woman with a close-cropped afro, said. Sam's heart gave a great thumping kick in his chest. "No, that's my father-in-law. I'm Sam Levy Weinberg." Terrible thoughts were running through his mind, all involving Connor, who'd gone to a birthday party at the La Brea Tar Pits that afternoon. "Did something happen? What's wrong?" The second officer, a tall man with tanned white skin and curly reddish-brown hair, said, "Maybe we should talk inside." Sam led them to the kitchen.
"Who's there?" his father-in-law was yelling. "What's going on?"
Ignoring him, Sam said, "Would you like coffee, water, something to drink?" "Does Julie Berenger live here?" the female officer asked. Sam was still holding the dish towel, twisting it in his hands. "I'm her husband. She kept her last name." The male officer bent his head.
"I'm sorry, sir. We have bad news."
They told him that there'd been a bad accident on the 405. Julie's Prius had been rear-ended, shoved into the guardrail at the median by kids joyriding in one of their daddy's Range Rovers. The driver of the Rover had a concussion. Julie had been killed. While the officers were talking, the 2 nurses on duty had come to the kitchen where they stood to hear the news. The three of them were standing there, motionless, speechless, when Sam heard the front door swing open and heard Connor's happy shout, "Sam, I'm home!" followed by the unmistakable tootle of a kazoo. Connor came skipping into the kitchen, carrying a paper gift bag full of party favors, with the instrument in question in his other hand. "Maya's mom says that Rexton's parents were sadists for giving us kazoos, but she wouldn't tell us what a sadist is," he announced breathlessly. Then he turned and saw the police officers and went immediately still. Sam felt the horror of what had happened settle into his bones. "I have to tell him," he thought. "Oh God, how do I tell him?" Connor's dark eyes swept the room. The two police officers, the nurses, Sam with a dish towel twisted in his hands, his grandfather braying, "What's happening?" from the living room and being for once ignored. "What's wrong?" Connor asked in his husky voice. Sam hunkered down so he could look Connor in the eyes. "My God," he thought, "how do I do this? What do I say?" "Connor," he said, and cleared his throat. "I have bad news."
"Is it Mom?" Connor asked, his voice rising. "What happened? Just tell me."
"There was a bad car accident," Sam said. "I'm so sorry, honey. Your mom is dead." He watched as Connor's eyes got big and saw the moment the news landed. He held the boy while he cried and, after a murmured conversation with the nurses, dispatched one of them to give Saul the news. "What?" he heard Saul shouting as Connor sobbed, "No, no, no," and pummeled Sam's shoulders with his fists.
"Who?"
Then,
"I'm going to sue those sons of bitches. Give me Abrams on the phone."
Meanwhile, Connor clutched at Sam with panicky arms.
"Are you going to stay here? Please don't leave, Sam."
Sam swallowed hard. He felt dizzy, his brain overloaded. He could smell salmon and garlic and could hear his father-in-law shouting and could see the table he'd just finished setting for three. Julie's yoga mat stood curled up by the front door, her rolled-up grippy socks beside it. Her favorite coffee mug rested in the drainer. The olive oil cake she'd baked 2 days ago was still in its pan, covered in tinfoil. Everything was here except Julie. It didn't feel real. "I'm not going anywhere," Sam promised Connor, "no matter what." That night, after Connor had been coaxed to eat a few bites of macaroni and cheese, after Sam had struggled to answer question after question about where his mommy was now and what would happen to her, and had it hurt when the car had hit her, and was she going in the ground, and what would happen to her there, and was she going to watch over him from heaven, because that's what Logan P. at nursery school told Connor people did after they died. Sam had tucked the boy into bed, made his way downstairs, and poured himself 2 fingers of whiskey. He'd decided to sleep in Connor's room, on the floor beside Connor's bed. He couldn't even look at the room he and Julie had shared, couldn't imagine sleeping in their bed without Julie beside him. He was hunting through the closet for his sleeping bag when the phone rang. "Sam? Hey, hi, is everything all right? Are you okay? I got the strangest feeling this afternoon." That old twin ESP, he thought, and cleared his throat. "Julie's dead."
"What?
What?" his sister cried then. "Oh, God, you're kidding me. What happened? Oh, my God, that poor little boy." Sarah had started to cry. "I mean, poor you, poor Julie. But my God, poor Connor." Sam was crying. He'd held it together for Connor, but now he couldn't have stopped the tears if he'd tried. "Come home," said his sister. "Sarah, I don't know if I can. I can't leave Connor, and his father is here. Oh, like he'd give a shit," Sarah said, her voice uncharacteristically sharp. "Like he'd even notice. And didn't you tell me he'd be out of town for 3 months? "He's playing in Branson," said Sam, "but California is the only place Connor's ever lived. And," Sam continued, "I don't know if I'm even allowed to take him anywhere." Sam called himself Connor's stepfather, but he'd never officially adopted Connor. He had no idea what his legal standing might be. "Find out," said his sister with her voice cracking. "I just can't stand thinking about you and Connor being there in that house without Julie." Sam promised that he'd consider it, but in the end, it was Saul Behringer who decided for him. Summoning him to the living room in his familiar obnoxious bellow early the next morning.
"What's the plan, son?"
Saul demanded when Sam was standing in front of his hospital bed. "For Julie?" Sam swallowed. "Her body is still at the morgue. They have to do an autopsy because—" he gulped again, "because of how she died. Once they release the body, I thought we'd bury her," Saul interrupted.
"Her mom's at Hillside Memorial. So is her sister. She should go there."
"That's fine," Sam said. "I'll make the arrangements."
"Good. Now," he craned his neck up, baring his teeth, "I'll give you 2 weeks to pack up and clear out."
Sam stared at his stepfather. "Excuse me, what?"
"You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here," the old man said. His lips curled back, revealing his dentures.
Sam stared at him. "Excuse me?"
"It's my house. I want you out. You and the kid."
Sam's hands were forming fists of their own accord. "Julie was your daughter. That kid is your grandson."
"Is your name on the deed of this domicile?"
The old man paused, head cannily tilted.
"No. Didn't think so. I'll evict you if I have to. But it doesn't have to get ugly. Just pack your things and go."
"You'd do that," Sam said. His voice was faint with disbelief. He felt like he'd been hit over the head hard. He wanted to hit Saul someplace even harder. "You'd put your own grandson out on the street." Saul waved one large spotted hand dismissively.
"He'll have plenty of money once I'm gone, but hopefully that won't be for a while."
The old man drew himself up straight.
"I want the place to myself."
This cannot be happening, Sam thought. This can't be real. He made his way out of the living room, through the foyer, out the front door where he stood breathing the cool desert air. Then he thought, why should we stay? True, this house had been Connor's home for years. But just because it was familiar didn't mean it wasn't toxic, full of dread and bad smells and the echoes of Saul's querulous shouts. Sam had enough money to provide one little boy with a stable existence outside of these walls. "He can stay with me, and I can take care of him," Sam had thought. "Maybe we can actually go home." And 6 weeks later, when the school year ended, that's what he and Connor had done. "Tell Connor hi from me," said Ruby, as she said goodbye to her uncle after giving him the date and time for the ceremony. "Tell him we're so excited to see him." Sam promised that he would and congratulated her again. Then he'd hung up the phone, pleased and unsettled, a fizzing sensation in his bloodstream. "I'll have to tell Sarah," he thought, "of this thing that he'd only just figured out about himself. I'll have to tell Mom." But he wouldn't need to tell them immediately. After the wedding, Sam thought, he'd leave Connor with his mom and his sister for a few nights and finally get some answers.
Sarah. "He's having an affair," Sarah said, gasping the words between breaths as she and her best friend speed-walked through Prospect Park. It was just after 7 o'clock on a cool late March morning, and the park bustled with walkers, joggers, cyclists in Lycra leaning hard into the turns. "Oh, he is not," said Marnie Silver, who'd gotten divorced after her own affair when her third daughter was just 9 months old and lived to tell the tale, as she liked to say. Marnie and Sarah were both dressed in leggings, with sheer cutouts and sneakers with excellent arch support. Marnie had on a light jacket with stripes of silvery reflective tape.
Sarah wore a long-sleeved magenta t-shirt made of some magical sweat-wicking fabric. Both women pumped their arms as they walked and dreamed, or at least Sarah did, of the days when they'd been runners, before hip pain or back problems had slowed them down. "None of us left our houses for most of last year," Marnie said to Sarah, as they rounded the curve by the pond. "When would he have met someone? When would he have seen her?" "Maybe online," Sarah said. "Maybe it's an emotional affair." Marnie turned her head to look at Sarah without breaking her stride. "I'm just checking. Are we talking about the same person here? Eli Danhauser, the most devoted husband in history?" Sarah allowed herself a brief flush of pleasure at her friend's words, before letting anxiety replace satisfaction. "Something's off. Something's wrong. I know it is." Marnie pursed her lips. "You don't think maybe you're being paranoid because everything is so..." She waved both her hands, a gesture encompassing, Sarah presumed, the pandemic, the election, the shelter-in-place orders, the vaccine rollout, virtual school, and maybe even Sarah's father's death a few months before the first case of COVID was reported, an absence that still felt raw and new. "He's changed," Sarah said. "He looks right through me. It's like I'm barely even there." That was especially painful because for years, as Marnie well knew, Eli had been the very best of husbands. He'd always been attentive, solicitous, respectful, and kind, not to mention surprisingly sexy. For the duration of their marriage, every few months on a Friday afternoon or Saturday morning, Sarah would get a text, "Meet me at the bar at town." She'd go through her closet, selecting her clothes and especially her underwear with special care, feeling her pulse quickening. She'd arrive at the bar and Eli would be there, wearing something that she'd never seen, a new tie or shirt, an always different cologne. "Buy you a drink?" he'd offer. "I'm Dave, or Mike, or Mark, or Gary from Bar Harbor, or Cleveland, or Des Moines." He'd give her a name and a job. Sarah would invent a character of her own. She'd been a journalist on an out-of-town assignment, a painter in town for a bridal shower, a sorority girl having her first legal drink. She and Eli would sit at the bar, exchanging details of their made-up lives. Eventually, their hands would brush, or she'd feel Eli's hand on her leg, one sure finger crooked against the soft flesh underneath her knee. "Want to get out of here and go someplace we can be alone?" he'd ask. "Or can I show you my hotel room?" They'd go to the room that Eli had reserved and make love, for the first time as these invented people. Sometimes it would be Tinder. She'd pretend to be a virgin who'd never even touched herself, and Eli had eased her onto the bed, kissing her for long, languorous minutes, slowly pulling off each piece of clothing, asking, "Can I touch you here? Can I kiss you?" as he led her gently toward her very first orgasm. Sometimes it would be rough. Eli would open the hotel room door, and almost before it was shut, he'd have her by the shoulders, pressing her up against the wall, grabbing one wrist and tugging it down to his erection while he bit her neck, and kissed her lips and whispered, "You're driving me crazy, you know that, right?" He'd yank off her panties, pull up her skirt, drop to his knees with his face between her legs. And then he'd stand up, grabbing her hips, spinning her, making her put her hands flat against the wall, panting, "I can't wait anymore. I need to be inside you." As good as their at-home Eli and Sarah sex was, that hotel room sex was spectacular. It showed that Eli never took her for granted, how he worked to keep things interesting, how on each one of those dates, he'd woo her and win her all over again. And now Sarah couldn't remember the last time they'd had any sex of any variety at all. She missed it. She missed him. She missed having a partner, someone intimately familiar with the details of the life they'd built together. Right now, more than anything, she missed someone who would join his voice to hers and tell her stubborn stepdaughter that getting married at 22 was insane and that she couldn't, shouldn't do it. And Eli was completely oblivious, physically present, emotionally gone. It would have been bad if Eli had just ignored her, but that wasn't all. For the years they'd been married, Sarah had done her best to ignore Eli's annoying habits, the volume at which he chewed, the way he'd leave his sweaty workout clothes in a sodden pile on the bathroom floor, and how he never remembered to clean his beard stubble out of the sink after he shaved. In the early days of their marriage, Sarah would fret about his shortcomings. She would discuss these failings with him calmly. She'd reminded him politely. She'd even screamed at him a few times before realizing that she was, as the self-help book said, sweating the small stuff. Eli was never going to change. She had two choices. She could expend her time and energy on getting him to act differently, or she could make peace with his minor acts of slovenliness. Sarah went for the second option. She knew that it could have been worse. The evidence was all around her. A friend's husband who'd been hiding a meth addiction. Another friend whose husband had drained their bank accounts during a year's worth of secret late-night online poker sessions. A third marriage that had ended after the wife had an affair with her spin instructor, which, in addition to being shameful, was a total cliché. Sarah remembered how when Dexter was in kindergarten, a wave of divorces had swept through his class, almost as if marital discord were a cold that was catching. Sarah would hear about one couple after another, being in counseling, or taking some time apart, or separating or divorcing. One little boy or girl after another would become the owner of two separate backpacks, one for mommy's house and one for daddy's, and go trudging stoically between two domiciles, usually at that point with a therapist of their own. It broke Sarah's heart, even though Dexter thought those kids had won the lottery. Two bedrooms, two doting parents or sets of parents, two holiday and birthday celebrations with twice as many gifts. In a plaintive voice, Dexter would ask why he couldn't have two birthday parties like Madison, or celebrate Christmas and Hanukkah like Taylor S., or go to Florida like Taylor Z and her dad and her dad's new girlfriend. Sarah had felt proud, even the tiniest bit smug, about her own marriage. It was a version of the same pride she'd felt starting 7 or 8 years after her own wedding, when all the friends and colleagues and classmates who'd asked if she was sure, really sure about Eli, if she was positive about becoming a stepmother, if she'd thought about what she was getting into, all the women who'd told jokes that weren't really jokes about how Sarah was a child bride and how she'd be the wicked stepmother, no matter how kindly she behaved. By the time they were in their mid-30s, all of those women had ended up scrambling around, as Marnie put it, like the very last shoppers at the Filene's basement semi-annual sale. Only instead of grabbing at discounted wedding gowns, they were snatching up any presentable, employed, marriage-minded man who hadn't already been claimed. Who's laughing now? Sarah had thought, as friend after friend had walked down the aisle with her own Mr. Not Quite Right, a man who looked or sounded or behaved like clearance merchandise, the dinged or damaged goods you'd find on the shelves at Marshall's or TJ Maxx, the imperfects. Sarah watched, sympathetic but unsurprised, as some of the marriages wobbled unsteadily forward and some imploded after a year or two. Meanwhile, she had been a decade into her own marriage. She and Eli had two gorgeous babies, her beautiful boys, and Ruby had stopped hating her and had become one of Sarah's favorite people. Staying married, she'd decided, was a choice. One that had less to do with love and more with forbearance. You recommitted yourself to your spouse every time you overlooked a pair of sweat-soaked boxer shorts in the corner of the bathroom, every time you swept, without comment, toenail clippings from the bedroom floor, Every time you'd pick a different coffee shop after finding yourself buoyant and flushed and a little too eager to see that one barista with tattoo sleeves and the large, capable-looking hands. Every day, at least once, Sarah would find herself looking around her beautiful kitchen, with the skylight she'd added, or at Ruby as she came bounding through the door, and she would think, "I made the right choice. I did the right thing." But all those years of tamping down her annoyance must have had some effect, nibbling away at her patience. When the pandemic hit, and Eli went from spending his days out of the house to being inside with her all the time, staring into his patients' mouths on his computer screen, lecturing on oral anatomy for the course he taught at Columbia School of Dentistry via Zoom, Sarah found that whatever tolerance she'd cultivated over the years had frayed to the point of non-existence, and whatever reserves of goodwill she'd stored up had been drained. Just the sight of a bowl crusted with the residue of cereal around its rim, or one of those sweaty t-shirts she'd spent years ignoring, could make her murderous. Just the sound of his orthopedic flip-flops slap-slapping up the stairs made her incandescent with rage. "Maybe it's perimenopause," she said to Marnie as they finished their last lap and slowed their pace. "But it used to be I'd only want to kill him maybe once a year," she considered. "Maybe twice a year. Only now it's like weekly, sometimes daily." She felt herself scowling and did her best to relax her face, not wanting to end up prematurely wrinkled. It was a warm spring morning, the trees all glowing gold and green, the air sweet and clear, and Sarah couldn't enjoy it at all. Between her stepdaughter's ill-conceived plans and the husband whose life she wanted to end, she'd lost the ability to notice the weather or to appreciate a beautiful day. "Just so I understand, you're terrified that he's cheating and you also want him dead?" Sarah considered the contradiction. Then she said, "Yes." "Got it," Marnie said, nodding as if that made perfect sense. "Maybe it's proximity," she said. "Look, all of our routines have been disrupted. Everything's upside down. And you're planning a wedding on top of it all, so he's probably freaking out about his little girl getting married and the inevitability of his own death." She paused to inhale. "Give it time. Next September, God willing, the boys will be back in school full time. The wedding will be in the rear view mirror, and Eli will be back at the office. Things will be better." It made sense, except Sarah didn't know how much longer she could hold on. The pandemic had left her spacious house feeling punishingly small. Ruby and Gabe had claimed the fourth floor. Dexter and Miles had taken over the third. Eli's office was on the second story, but he'd roam up and down from the first floor to his office and back down again, flip-flopping all the way. From her desk or her bed, Sarah could hear everything that happened in the house, the creak of the floorboards as Eli paced, Miles's voice during his classes, the crashes and exclamations as Dexter dropped things, and even, God help her, the thump of the headboard against the wall and the occasional moan from Ruby and Gabe's Erie. Sarah loved her family. She loved her boys, especially because their existence had never been a given. Her life could have gone in a different direction. If she'd devoted herself to her music, the way her teachers had wanted, if she'd gone to a conservatory for college instead of getting a liberal arts degree, if she'd pushed herself to the very limits of her talent, forsaken all her other interests and hobbies and practiced 5 or 6 hours a day, she could have made it. Could have been performing with symphonies or doing residencies in Vienna, or making records for Deutsche Grammophon. Maybe she'd chosen the safer path, the easier, more familiar road, where she played for herself and occasionally dazzled one of the kids who came into her office at the music school. Sarah would play one of her old recital pieces, Grieg's Concerto in A minor, or Chopin's Fantaisie Impromptu, and watch their eyes get wide and their mouths drop open. "Miss Sarah, you're good," they'd say. Or they'd put their hands at the sides of their heads, then draw them outward, making exploding noises to suggest that their minds had been blown.
"I was good," Sarah would think. "And I might have been great if I'd worked for it." But she'd made her choice, and she'd tried not to look back or think about the road not taken. For the most part, she'd been happy. When the babies came, au pairs and babysitters and eventually Ruby's help meant she could go back to work and know that her babies were safe and well cared for. She'd had her solitude, the hour in the morning after Eli had left for work and the kids had left for school, when she could sit with her second cup of coffee and do the crossword puzzle, or fold a load of laundry, or straighten up the kitchen, or read a chapter of a book, or just enjoy the quiet. She'd loved the weekend afternoons, when the kids would be at sports practices or playdates, and Eli would be out with his buddies, riding his bike or playing pickup basketball with the other dads. She would sit in the living room by herself and listen to music, or half-watch some show about tiny houses on TLC while she made her weekly shopping list. At night, she'd savor a quiet hour alone in the kitchen, after everyone had gone to sleep, prepping the next night's dinner or paging through cookbooks while she sipped a cup of tea. Eli knew how much her alone time meant to her, and all through their marriage, he'd done what he could to preserve it. When Ruby was little, Sarah and Eli had allowed her to spend time in the summer with Sarah's parents on the Cape, a respite that gave Sarah and Eli time together and Sarah time by herself. When the boys came along, twice a year, Eli would take them camping for a weekend. They'd load up a rented SUV with tents and backpacks, sleeping bags and coolers, more food than they could ever eat, and more gear than they'd ever use. Fishing poles and firewood, mountain bikes and flashlights, and tarps and special bags to keep the food away from bears. Sarah would help them pack. She'd carry bags to the car. She'd stand on the steps, cheerfully waving goodbye. And then, once they were gone, she'd do an exultant jump in the air, thrilled at the thought of three entire nights where she would have the house all to herself. The pandemic had stolen those precious days and hours. Even when everyone was tucked away in their bedrooms, Sarah could feel them, as if their presence had a physical weight or a sound. It was the constancy of it, the unendingness. She felt crowded and edgy and half crazy. Every time she turned around, there was someone standing too close to her, speaking too loudly, needing something. "Mom, have you seen my sweatshirt? Mom, can we have chicken with mashed potatoes for dinner? Mama, do you know where my phone charger went? Sorry, Mrs. D, but we're out of toilet paper on the fourth floor." Every request, no matter how polite, clawed at her with sharp nails. Every breath of air in the house felt stale and flat, like it had already been in and out of someone else's lungs. Every surface she touched felt sticky. And she knew from her friends that she wasn't the only woman feeling that way. They were all trying to do too much for too many people in too little space, trying to manage their jobs and their kids' schooling, the meals and the housework and their working from home partners or spouses, while they clung to sanity with their fingernails. As the months went by, Sarah thought that if there wasn't a true end coming soon, there'd be a wave of women leaving their marriages, just as there'd already been a wave of women leaving the workforce. They'd log on to Expedia en masse. They'd buy themselves one-way tickets to the most deserted parts of the world with no plans to ever come home. When Ruby and Gabe moved out, Sarah felt a measure of relief. When the boys began in-person school again, she told herself that things were getting better. Then Eli had declared 2021 the year of buying nothing and launched a major purge. "We're at the stage of our lives where we need to start getting rid of things, not acquiring more," he'd announced, with a significant look in the direction of Sarah's side of the closet, where the racks and shelves were, admittedly, quite full. Sarah's job at the music school had no dress code.
If she'd wanted to, she could have worn jeans and blouses or even t-shirts and sneakers to work. But Sarah loved clothes. She loved finding new boutiques and discovering new designers. She loved the feeling of buying the perfect azure blue necklace to wear with a new navy blue dress and a pair of vintage leather riding boots to pull the look together. Even the clothes she didn't wear made her happy. She'd brush the sleeve of the pale pink cashmere sweater she'd worn on her second date with Eli and feel again the first flush of infatuation. She'd flick past the black gown she'd worn for her last recital and feel a bittersweet pang. She loved the challenge of putting together an outfit, searching out each individual piece, shopping her closet, combining old and new. Getting dressed was its own kind of creativity, and it satisfied her in the same primal way she imagined gathering a perfect sheaf of wheat or an unblemished handful of berries might have delighted her hunting and gathering forebearers. Eli, who treated his suits and ties like a uniform, didn't get it. He'd read a book about Swedish death cleaning and joined a buy-nothing group on Facebook and various upcycling and barter groups online. He donated their belongings and gave things away, and when there were items he couldn't donate or trade away, he'd simply leave them on the sidewalk, which meant that every week or so, Sarah would walk outside of their building to take Lord Farquaad for a stroll and discover some cherished belonging on the stoop with a "Take Free" sign taped to it somewhere. At first, Sarah had been fully on board with this project. They did have too many things. The house was getting too full. She'd helped Eli excavate Ruby's child-sized desk from where it had been sitting, ignored in the back of their basement for the past 10 years, and donate it to a family shelter. She'd been fine giving away the bread machine, a wedding gift she'd used once before deciding that she preferred baking bread from scratch. She'd collected boxes of board books and chapter books that the boys no longer read. She'd had Ruby help her perform a merciless edit on her closet, getting rid of anything that didn't fit or that she hadn't worn or that was not attached to some specific pleasant memory. "Do not let me backslide," she'd told her stepdaughter, as they'd filled 3 contractor-sized trash bags. And Ruby had whisked the discards out of the house, never to be seen again. It was fine that Eli wanted them to pare back, to reduce, reuse, and recycle. It was not fine when she'd find that he'd gotten rid of something she actually did use or wanted to keep. She'd had to wrestle her old leather bomber jacket, purchased in college with a small "Keep Your Laws Off My Body" pin still attached to its lapel, away from some hipster girl with a pink bob and a pierced nose. "But it's vintage," the girl had wailed, which hadn't made Sarah feel good about herself or the state of women's reproductive rights in America. That had been bad, but not as bad as the morning she'd walked outside to discover her beloved Le Creuset Dutch oven sitting on their stoop. She marched upstairs in high dudgeon, the vessel clutched to her chest. Eli had blinked at her, perplexed. "You still use that?" he asked. On his face was Sarah's least favorite expression, the one where his forehead was furrowed, mouth slightly agape in a way that made him look slightly concussed. "I thought it was just taking up space on the stove." Sarah didn't want to explain to him that his taking up space was her making the kitchen more attractive. That while he saw a pot unused and extraneous, she saw her history. She didn't want to explain to him again, since he'd clearly forgotten, that the Dutch oven, with all of its chips and scratches, had belonged to her parents, that it had been one of their wedding gifts, and that even if Sarah only used it a handful of times each year for their Hanukkah brisket or for matzo ball soup, when it was her turn to host Passover, it had meaning for her. It still, as they said, sparked joy. Its rich red-orange color lifted her mood a little every time her gaze happened upon it. When she ran her hands along its smooth enameled curves, she thought about her mom and the holidays they'd spent together. She'd tried to explain this to Eli, who'd listened, nodding along, promising to do better. "Sorry," he said. "I won't do it again. I'll ask before I get rid of anything else." That, it emerged, was a lie. As the spring progressed, every few days, Sarah would look for something. Her set of 2-pound hand weights, the ceramic vase she'd bought in Mexico the year they'd gone to Tulum, the blue and white teacups from Chinatown, or her collected Shakespeare from college, and discover it wasn't there. "I don't understand," Eli would say. "I thought we agreed about this." He'd draw himself up proudly. "I got rid of all my dental textbooks." "Eli," Sarah sounded as weary as she felt, "nobody wants dental textbooks. They were just taking up space." "Right. That's why I got rid of them." "I can get rid of things," Sarah said. She'd hold up her Shakespeare collection or her teacups. "But not this thing." "So not any things," Eli would say. And Sarah would have to press her lips together to keep from saying truly hurtful things, things she could never take back. She didn't understand what had happened, or why Eli not only no longer saw their belongings, but no longer saw her, either. Who she was, what she liked and used, what was meaningful and what was not. Which made her feel okay about lying. It was easy to do. Eli was smart, but not especially observant when it came to women's clothes or accessories. "Are those new?" he'd ask, peering at her earlobes or staring severely at a dress. "This old thing," she'd say, or touching her earrings, she'd say, "I've had these for 1,000,000 years, knowing that Eli wouldn't be able to tell for sure whether she'd owned something for decades or had bought it the week before. She could have kept lying. She could have endured the new austerity, the buy-nothing group, the compost bin he'd set up on the kitchen counter, and the hipsters she'd find hovering by her front door every few mornings, their faces hopeful above their masks. She could have lived with the stories she'd been forced to invent to counter his relentless attempts to purge their lives of everything she loved. She could have made herself endure it. But then there were the flip-flops. "I need to tell you something," Eli had said years ago when they'd first started dating. They'd been in a restaurant, and he'd reached across the table to take her hands. Sarah looked at his serious expression and felt a prickle of unease. Had something bad happened to a patient? Was he sick? Or was he going to tell her that Annette had come back, that he had to give his ex-wife another chance, that Ruby deserved a real mother? She swallowed hard. Eli was already so dear to her, with his high forehead, his curly hair, and his sweet smile. Eli was wonderful, and dating was awful. There'd been guys she'd liked who'd never called, guys she hadn't liked who had called, and called, and called, and then had showed up at her apartment or her office, refusing to take no for an answer. And of course, there'd been her first boyfriend, who'd broken her heart so completely that it had taken her a full year before she'd allowed another boy to even hold her hand. She sat back, bracing herself, and then Eli had gravely announced, "I have plantar fasciitis." "What is it? Is it bad?" she'd asked. It certainly sounded bad. "Well, it's uncomfortable," Eli allowed, with a modest look suggesting that he was nobly enduring, with barely a word of complaint, agony that would have reduced a lesser man to writhing and groans. As soon as she got home, Sarah had looked up his condition. Plantar fasciitis, an inflammation of the tissue connecting the heel bone to the toes. Treatments, she read, include physical therapy, shoe inserts, steroid injections, and rarely surgery. "It's a man thing," Marnie told her when Sarah called. "Men don't get headaches, they get migraines. They don't get colds, it's always double pneumonia." "So Eli doesn't have sore heels, he's got plantar whatever. Just indulge him." Sarah had. Over the years, she'd heard her husband talk about his condition so often that her brain automatically shut down at the sound of its name. Then, at a dinner party on the Cape, one of Sarah's mother's friends turned out to be a fellow sufferer. She'd told Eli about the flip-flops she'd started wearing. "They changed my life," she'd said with her hand on her heart. Intrigued, Eli had pulled out his phone and ordered a pair on the spot. The flip-flops, made in China and back-ordered for months after a mention in Runner's World, hadn't arrived until March, right before the lockdowns began. They weren't cheap, but they looked that way. A pair of ugly, plastic-soled shoes, gray on the bottom, spongy white on top, with a black strap that went between the wearer's toes. They made the usual flip-flop slapping sound when Eli walked, which might not have been annoying in smaller increments or at a lower volume, or in the summertime, when the sound was part of the oral landscape of the season. But in the midst of a pandemic, in a house with hardwood floors, the sound of Eli slap-slapping his way through his days had become maddening, especially because it turned out that Eli was a pacer who walked when he was talking on the phone. From dawn until bedtime, Sarah would hear the schlep, schlep sound of his flip-flopped feet. She'd sit at her desk, back stiff, fingers on the keyboard, her entire posture telegraphing the fact that she was working or thinking or busy, or she'd lie on the bed curled around her book when she heard his footsteps coming her way. "Just getting my book," he'd announce as she'd hunch close to her own book or her phone or her computer screen, trying not to lose her train of thought, her body language silently announcing, "Leave me alone." When the pandemic began, she'd ask him not to interrupt her, to just come and go quietly if she was in the middle of something, and he'd nodded and agreed. Maybe he'd forgotten his pledge, or maybe it ran counter to his nature. But Eli seemed as incapable of not talking to her upon arriving as he did of remembering to wipe out the sink's bowl after he finished shaving. "Just plugging in my phone," he would call, or "just grabbing a sweater," or "just going out to get Lord Farquaad's food." Every time her husband came slap-slapping his way into the bedroom, she'd feel her stomach muscles clench and her heart start beating faster and her fingers itch with a desire to slap him. "Please, you think you've got it bad?" asked Tasha, her assistant, when Sarah had complained on a work Zoom. "I learned that my husband's a circle-back guy." She'd lowered her voice to what Sarah thought of as a business casual baritone.
Bob, can we circle back on that?"
Then Carol, one of the teachers, shared that her husband cracked his knuckles, and Justin, who taught the trombone, confessed to daily bickering with Timothy, his sax player husband, over where he and Justin could each empty their respective spit valves, and about the reed pairings Timothy left on the floor. "You don't really think he's cheating, do you?" Marnie asked as they turned the corner, crossing the sidewalk where the park became the city.
"I don't know." Sarah felt wretched. "I don't know what I think. Maybe it's not that, but there's something going on."
"If you want my advice," Marnie looked sideways, waiting for Sarah to say that she didn't. When Sarah said nothing, Marnie touched her shoulder.
"Just ignore it. Whatever he's doing that's driving you nuts, just ignore it. You don't want to end your marriage over the small stuff." She sighed. "Or at all, if you can help it."
Marnie was speaking from experience. She'd gone back to work 6 weeks after the birth of her second daughter and had fallen in love with her new editor, a single man 5 years younger than she was. It might have been nothing more than an unrequited crush or harmless flirting, except the editor, Jeff, enthusiastically returned Marnie's affections. He swore she was his soulmate, the only woman he had loved or could ever love. Marnie and Jeff had carried on an affair for 6 months. Then Marnie had gotten pregnant, and because she believed that she and Jeff were meant to be, she told her husband that she was leaving him. Her husband, Jonathan, had begged her to stay, to go to counseling with him, to think of their children, He'd even promised to raise the baby as their own. But Marnie was resolute. In my defense, she'd say, when she was telling the story, and Marnie told the story a lot, I was hormonal and exhausted. Jonathan wasn't helping with the girls, and Jeff was promising to marry me at the time. Eventually, Jonathan surrendered and agreed to the divorce. And then, to no one's surprise, once Marnie was single, available, and 7 months pregnant, Jeff had reconsidered. When Marnie emerged from that terrible whirlwind of a year, she had no husband, no boyfriend, a new baby, and barely any job. Because when the magazine's publishers learned of the affair, they'd reassigned Jeffrey and demoted Marnie, changing her status from staff writer to freelancer, lopping $30,000 off her salary and taking away her benefits, too. Jonathan, meanwhile, lost 15 pounds, acquired a wardrobe of dark-rinsed jeans and V-necked cashmere sweaters, and began dating beautiful women in their 20s. 5 years later, Marnie, now the single mother of three girls, was still struggling to rebuild her life, her savings, and her self-esteem, trying to get back to where she'd been before Hurricane Jeff. She loved her daughters, but she was transparent about how hard it was for her to do alone, and her example was never far from Sarah's mind. In your marriage, and you and your children will suffer. Sarah had taken that lesson to heart. Ever since her wedding, she had never come close to thinking about walking away. Eli was a good man. He'd never cheated or done any of the other objectionable things her friends' husbands had done, like quitting his job and announcing he wanted to become a rodeo clown, or gambling away all of their money, or getting fired and not telling his wife, and continuing to put on a suit and tie and leave the house every morning at 8 a.m. so she'd think he was still working. Eli had been the foundation upon which she had built her life and her family. And now it was like learning the foundation was made of soap bubbles, like an anchor that had looked substantial but was really just styrofoam painted to look like iron. The pandemic had been awful. She'd hoped things would change once the vaccines were available and the world went back to something that looked like normal. But nothing had changed. Eli was still distracted and distant. He barely listened when she spoke. When they gathered in the family room to play board games or watch TV, he'd have to be reminded when it was his turn, or he'd get up after 20 minutes and go drifting through their house like a ghost. A ghost on noisy flip-flops, Sarah thought. She'd held on for as long as she could, telling herself that marriages went through rough patches, and that the one she and Eli were currently enduring would end. But finally in January, during a stretch of days where it felt like the sun never came out, after she'd had to listen to Eli give a lecture on the anatomical structures of the tongue, delivered while holding his phone and flip-flopping up and down the hall, she'd decided that she had to do something. She would have called her brother, who'd already sensed that something was wrong, but poor Sam had troubles enough of his own, and she didn't want to sound churlish or petty, complaining about her husband to a man who'd lost his wife. If her father had been alive, she might have asked his advice, and the idea that she couldn't, that he wasn't just away or unavailable, but gone forever, had hit her again and left her red-eyed and sniffly. So instead, one morning, right after Eli had left the house, Sarah had reached for the bat phone and called her mom. "Hello?" Veronica had said, sounding slightly out of breath. When the phone had been ringing, Sarah had pictured her mother rooting through one of her tote bag-sized purses, groping for her phone. Sarah and her mother spoke every Friday night after Shabbat dinner, and two or three afternoons a week, Sarah would dial her mom's number as she walked the boys home from school and let them tell their softa about their day. She never called Veronica first thing in the morning. "Hi, Mom." "Sarah, what's wrong?" She hadn't been surprised that all she had to say was hello for her mom to sense that there was trouble. Sarah imagined she'd be the same with her own children, when they were grown and gone.
"Nothing, nothing, everything's fine," Sarah had said. Her mother waited. "It's just, well, I've been thinking about renting a studio, just to have a little space."
"A room of one's own," her mother had said, in a non-committal tone.
"The house is fabulous. I'm so grateful. I'll always be grateful. But with Ruby and her boyfriend here and the boys doing virtual school, it's just feeling a little crowded."
Her mother hadn't responded. Sarah had made herself continue.
"I think if I had a little space, like a studio, I could move my piano there. That way I wouldn't bother anyone and they wouldn't bother me, and I could have some privacy again."
She had waited for her mother to point out that Ruby and Gabe wouldn't stay forever, that the boys would eventually go back to school, and Eli had already returned to his office. She hadn't been sure if Veronica remembered that, in addition to the baby grand piano that had been in the house in Cambridge and was now in Park Slope, Sarah also had a fancy electronic keyboard, a birthday gift from Eli. It sounded almost like a real piano, and it had all kinds of features, allowing her to record herself as she played or add drums or bass or, if she felt inclined, a bossa nova beat. Best of all, she could play it with headphones on.
"Did you ever feel like you needed some space for yourself? Away from us?" she had asked and swallowed hard. "Away from Dad?"
Sarah had expected an immediate no. Instead, her mother had sighed. "You don't remember, but before you and Sam were born, I spent a lot of time in New York."
"When you were writing," Sarah had said.
"When I was publishing," Ronnie had said. Sarah wasn't entirely clear why that distinction was important, but before she could ask, Ronnie had said,
"Have you talked to Eli?
I'm sure he'd get the boys out of the house, if that's what you needed. They're always welcome up here, you know. You are, too."
Sarah had heard, or thought she did, the faintest hint of criticism. Her mother, she knew, wanted them to spend their entire summers on Cape Cod, or at least visit more frequently. Sarah had closed her eyes, knowing if she answered, if she said the words out loud, it would all become real.
"I just need a little time by myself," she had said, her voice almost a whisper. "Maybe if I go away, I'll remember why I loved him," she thought. Her mother had waited, but Sarah had said all she was ready to say. She wasn't going to tell her mother how she felt like she was living with a ghost and not a partner, not a husband or a father, and certainly not a lover, because she couldn't even remember the last time Eli had reached for her in the night, bringing his lips to the back of her neck and kissing the spot just below her ear, the last time they'd played one of their games. "I hope you're giving Eli a chance. You can't just expect him to guess what's wrong," her mother had finally said. "Men aren't mind readers. If you don't tell him how you're feeling, he might not be able to figure it out."
Except once he could have, Sarah had thought. "He used to listen to me and notice how I was feeling. He used to pay attention. He used to care."
"I've tried to tell him," she had said. "Except, how could you tell your husband that every single thing about him was annoying you? That his indifference was making you feel like you didn't matter? And that you couldn't remember why you'd wanted to be with him in the first place?"
"I've tried," Sarah had said. "I have."
"Well," her mom had said, "if it's what you need, you should do it. And don't beat yourself up. From what I've read, there's lots of women locking themselves in their closets, or their bathrooms, or their basement storage units to get a little peace." That afternoon, Sarah booked a room at a hotel that was an easy walk from the house. That night after dinner and the bedtime rituals of kisses and glasses of water and a chapter of Captain Underpants, she'd faked a phone call and told Eli that Marnie was having a childcare emergency and that she was going over to help. "I'll spend the night if it gets too late," she had told Eli, who just nodded without looking up from his phone.
She'd grabbed the bag she'd packed before Eli's arrival from the closet and hurried along the slushy streets, barely feeling the cold air on her cheeks. When she had unlocked the door, pulled off her mask, and taken in the sight of the king-sized bed with its smooth covers and crisp pillowcases, the freshly vacuumed floor, the bottle of water on the bedside table, she had felt something inside of her unclench and loosen, like a too-tight bra that she'd finally unhooked. She had slipped off her shoes, put on her pajamas, washed her face, and brushed, but not flossed, her teeth. Those ablutions completed, she had settled her head on the pillow, closed her eyes, and fallen into the deepest and most peaceful sleep she'd enjoyed in months. The following week, she had gone on virtual tours of 4 different apartments, all of them convenient to the music school. The timing had worked in her favor. During the pandemic, people had fled the city in droves. Rents were low. Inventory was high. Landlords were waiving security deposits. It felt to Sarah like the world wanted this to happen. Within a week, she had signed a lease for a beautiful, high-ceilinged studio with a small kitchen and a black-and-white tiled bathroom, and arranged for a contact-free key transfer. Starting in February, every day or two, instead of taking lunch at her desk, Sarah would go to her new apartment. On the weekends, she'd tell Eli she was meeting Marnie for a walk or going to the music school for a few hours to work in her office while the building was empty. "Can you handle the boys?" she'd ask, and he'd say, "Of course," in a distracted tone, suggesting there'd be a surfeit of screen time in Dexter's and Miles's immediate future. She couldn't bring herself to care. Once she'd reached Manhattan and turned down the street that led to her new place, she'd feel her pace quickening, her chest loosening until she could take deep, cleansing breaths. She'd unlock the building's heavy front door, climb the 3 flights of stairs, and stand on the threshold, unmoving, appreciating the emptiness. She would sit on the hardwood floors in the center of her own 400 square feet, sometimes with her eyes closed, sometimes looking out the window or at the blank walls. For an hour or two, she would inhale that stillness, the air that had been breathed by no one but her. She'd buy fresh flowers every few days, extravagant bouquets of hydrangeas or lilies, and set them on the counter of the tiny kitchen. She'd listen to music, recordings of the pieces she'd pushed herself to master as a teenager, Bach's harpsichord concerti, Chopin's nocturnes, Debussy's arabesques. With the music in her ears, she would let herself imagine living here. A single bed against the wall, a couch just big enough for her, a television, a table, 2 bar stools at the counter, a different life. She told no one, not even Marnie. A home for one, for her alone, a room of one's own. The thought thrilled her and scared her, but as the weeks went on, she found herself more thrilled than scared. Slowly, she began to furnish the place. A single bed, and linens and pillows, a couch, a table, a television set. She had rented a piano and had it delivered during her lunch hour, telling herself that she wasn't moving her keyboard from home because she didn't want to have to move it back again. Not because she didn't want Eli to know what she was doing, and she'd play for hours, filling the empty room with music. She would keep the keys in her pocket, on a heavy fob of scrolled silver in the shape of the letter S. During the day, she'd find her fingers seeking the cool silvery surface, tracing the shape of the letter, transmitting the sensation of respite and relief from her skin to her brain. Her heartbeat would slow. The tension in her chest would loosen, and she'd feel a measure of peace, the calmness she needed to go on. "Call me if you want to talk later," Marnie reached down to squeeze Sarah's hand. The sun was fully risen, and the park was emptying out,
the bikers and the joggers doing their cool downs, the sidewalks full of people on their way to work or bringing kids to school. Sarah sighed. It was time to go home. By the time she'd made it through the front door of the brownstone, whatever peace she'd felt from the exercise and her friend's company had burned away, replaced by the resentment that was constantly present, seething right beneath her skin. Sarah took off her sneakers by the door. She was walking by the living room couch when something stirred. "Shit!" she yelped, as the blanket-covered lump rolled over and her brother-in-law's sleep-rumpled head emerged. "Oh, hey," Ari said, yawning. "Sorry, I had, an appointment in Williamsburg last night, and it ran late. Hope it's okay that I crashed here." Sarah rolled her eyes. She knew exactly what Ari meant by